Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio House Republicans today decide who among them will lead the next two-year session. Ryan Smith took over last spring as House Speaker when the former Speaker resigned amid the haze of an FBI investigation. He faces off, that is, Smith does, against another former Speaker, Larry Householder, who has worked fiercely to attract the needed 50 votes for the job. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us is Columbus Dispatch reporter Kathy Kandisky. Welcome back.
Happy Monday.
And Dayton Daily News Columbus Bureau reporter Laura Bischoff. Welcome back.
Hey, glad to be here.
And Cincinnati Enquirer state government reporter Jesse Ballmer. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So, you know, all of this could be decided within a matter of hours, or must it be decided today?
Today is their opening ceremonies, and they have a joint session with the Senate.
It's tradition.
Correct. If it follows the path that happened in June when they had to do 10 rounds of voting and on the 11th round.
Just for an interim speaker.
It could take quite a while. I think that they'll be doing voice votes again, which means the clerk of the House has to read 99 names 11 times. So get that man a beverage.
Yeah.
Throw a lozenger or something.
Exactly. How close is the vote for House Speaker?
It's pretty up in the air. Like, it sounds like Ryan Smith, who's the current Speaker or was the Speaker last year, he has maybe 34. Is that the right count? 34-ish?
34 or 35 for the
okay.
Republican
caucus. Then there's 38 Democrats, and then Larry Householder has the remainder. However, the Democrats met on Friday, and they splintered. And so Cleveland.com was reporting that maybe 20 Democrats or so are now deciding that they're going to support Householder.
Because
he made some promises about more bipartisanship and shared committee spots and...
Oh, really?
Didn't he say something about not going after labor? Some labor
not going after
well?
A right to work?
Correct. Well, yeah, there have been unions that have been advocating that the Democrats support Householder because he's made some indication that he will not seek right to work.
Yes, and unions, as we all know, are kind of a stalwart of Democratic fundraising, and they are important to Democrats running for office. Unions have donated money to Larry Householder when he was running for his seat in the Ohio House, and so I think Householder, it's fair to say, is the union's pick for Speaker, and that certainly is going to have some sway with Democrats in the Ohio House.
Huh. Correct. It's really going to be up to the Democrats, it seems, to decide who the next Speaker of the House is, and it'll be a Republican.
Which is really weird.
It's weird.
And you're saying, Laura, that he's not only got the organized labor in his corner, but he's also promising Democrats a little bit more room at the table.
Correct. And that maybe the committees might be more balanced. And I think right now that a lot of the committees, if it's a 10-member committee, it's 7 Republicans and 3 Democrats.
Right, because it's proportional.
So now it would be like 60-40.
Because that's how few Democrats are in the Ohio House.
Well, actually, the Democrats picked up some seats.
They did, I think, four or five seats.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. they're at like 38 out of 99.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's still...
They're still in the minority, solidly in the minority.
But in this particular instance, they have a lot of power.
The question is, like, what do they extract for it?
Right.
You know, and do they hold together to say, you know, here's our demands, this is what we really, really want? Or if they get splintered, then they don't have as much power to demand.
Correct.
You know.
Is there a sense about how they're talking about that?
I don't have a sense of it.
One for all and all for one, or...
Well, that's what they did in June. They all voted for Fred Strayhorn.
Right.
Well, they're supposed to be caucusing this morning, I think, before the vote, so it may not gel till that time.
Could this splinter that exists now, regardless of who ends up being Speaker, could this persist into the session and create other opportunities for Democrats?
I do think, regardless of who wins, either Larry Householder or Ryan Smith, you're going to see, especially in the budget vote, some fractures in how these people are voting. We've already seen it a little bit on the pay raise bill, where a majority of the Larry Householder supporters voted against that bill, whereas the Ryan Smith folks and the Democrats voted for that bill. And I think it's going to be hard for whoever ultimately becomes the leader to really lead this GOP caucus with so many divisions.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Also with us, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News and Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. If you have a question or comment, we've got a new session starting. We've got a new slate of executive office holders in Ohio. The inaugural events are all next week, but most of the office holder elects have been putting together their teams, and not the least of which is Mike DeWine, the governor-elect. He's working hard. He's certainly in a good position to put together a cabinet. He's been around for a long time and knows just about everybody. And obviously, the Republicans have an advantage. They've been controlling state government for so many years. There's a lot of experience.
Right.
I think that the governor-elect DeWine has named like maybe 20 or 21 people to cabinet and or high-level staff positions. And by my count, it was about half women, half men, I think maybe four or five African-Americans, including the woman he named to run the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, Annette Chambers-Smith. She'll be the first woman to lead that department. It is the largest department by headcount. They have 12,000 employees and 50,000 inmates in 27 facilities. It's a really big job. She is a Wilberforce University graduate, and had spent maybe 20-plus years in the department, and then recently went to the private sector and worked for a company called JPay that provides like emailing money transfer services to inmates in like 35 different states. Mm-hmm. So the DeWine administration wooed her back to Ohio, and so that I would say that's the biggest appointment so far.
I would agree, yeah.
Any significant holdovers from the Kasich administration? Or any at all?
I know the Opportunities for Ohioans with Disabilities leader is going to continue on, but I think most of the people are going to be new, and that makes sense. I think you would see more shakeup in the personnel if a Democrat would have won that spot, but I do think it makes sense for Mike DeWine to put his people in there.
What about Jobs Ohio?
Yeah, John Miner left, and I don't know. I think the board picks.
Anyway,
right.
Picks them. Okay,
But I might be wrong.
He's indicated that there's not going to be a change there, so if it's the board that picks, it'll stay that's the way it'll be.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's a couple of positions that are, you know, over a large amount of money or a large amount of people or just kind of sometimes controversial that are yet to be named. Notably, we don't have a leader for transportation yet or for Medicaid, which I think you'll see a lot of change in from both the federal and state level going forward. So that's interesting. Another person that I thought was an interesting pick was their legislative director, Dan McCarthy. He's a very well-known lobbyist on Capitol Square.
Is he independent?
He's actually a registered Democrat. Okay. His father is Democrat. He ran Democratic campaigns. And so it's just kind of interesting.
What do you make of that?
That he is going to be leading this Republican governor's policy on Capitol Square. I think Dan told me, and I think most people would agree, that he isn't a particularly partisan guy. But I do think if you are kind of the ultra-conservative wing of the Republican Party, you could be a little concerned that, you know, someone that perhaps doesn't share those values is going to be in charge of directing policy with lawmakers.
Is this Mike DeWine maybe reading the tea leaves and saying you've got to work more across the aisle with this kind of splintered caucus? And then
I think it speaks to kind of Dan's reputation around Capitol Square as kind of a straight shooter and a solid guy. And ultimately, he will be getting enacted the policy that he's directed to do by the governor. So that's going to be his job. His job really isn't to make his own policy. Mm-hmm. His job is to get it enacted, get the governor's agenda into law.
And, you know, Dan McCarthy's very close friends with John Husted as well. And he's yeah, he's well known. He's well respected. I asked him, you know, why give up a really lucrative lobbying career? He was an owner in the Success Group, And, you know, he just said that this is an opportunity to make a big difference, particularly on children's issues. And that's been like a marquee topic that Governor-elect DeWine wants to make an impact on.
I do think a thing that you can take away from this is Mike DeWine wants to have a good relationship with the Ohio legislature. And that has not necessarily been the hallmark of John Kasich's final years in office. There's been a lot of...
Actually, the reverse has been the hallmark.
Yes. Yeah. There's been a lot of vetoes. There's been a lot of overrides. There's been a lot of fights. There's been a lot of not communicating. He used to sit down regularly with the leaders of the Senate and the House, and that hasn't happened in months. So,
what are your expectations that Mike DeWine will be, you know, roll up his shirt sleeves and be that connected with the Ohio General Assembly, or will McCarthy be doing most of the heavy lifting?
I would think that I think DeWine will be very involved alongside with McCarthy. You know, McCarthy's going to be basically the legislative liaison.
Right.
You know, it doesn't hurt that he's got John Huston as his lieutenant governor. He's a former Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. And has a lot of connections in the legislature.
Yeah, right. You know, I remember the days, the olden days, when the House and the Senate leadership and the governor would all get together and roll out the budget.
Have dinner.
And there'd be things. Yeah, like they'd kind of roll it all out in this gigantic press conference. And
you know, keep in mind the big three, as they're called, the governor, yeah, the speaker, and the Senate president. Any one of those people who hold those positions can, you know, block something from becoming law, a bill from getting a vote, can have enormous sway over how the state spends billions and billions of dollars, how it regulates industries small and large, you know, these are very powerful positions.
Mike DeWine has said that he will embrace the Medicaid expansion, all things being equal, in some form or fashion. Is this a negotiating chip? I mean, is this something that he can compromise on and make some headway with the legislature?
I think the issue with Medicaid expansion is the work requirements, which the state has already submitted a waiver request to the federal government asking to impose work requirements that was directed by the legislature last year, and Ohio's waiting for an answer from the federal government. I expect that to be kind of the course on Medicaid expansion. I think Medicaid expansion is too important in the state's fight on the opioid crisis for anybody to want to roll that back.
Yeah, I think it would be hard politically to do that at this point. I do think there will be changes at the federal level that the state will have to adjust to. Already, we're going to be picking up a slightly larger portion of the bill just because of that's the way Obamacare was set up.
It was 90%. Now it's going to be increasingly more state.
Mm-hmm. And so I think you'll see, especially Ohio's Republican legislature trying to find ways to pinch pennies on that. John Kasich would say we've already pinched a lot of pennies. So it'll be interesting to see that dynamic going forward. But I guess I'd be very surprised if it disappears entirely.
He made one of his focuses, John Kasich did, reframing Medicaid and trying to not wring efficiencies from it, but make it more effective.
Managed care,
right.
Privatized a lot of it.
He is not appointed a Medicaid chief yet.
Not yet.
Right.
And Barbara Sears has indicated she's leaving. I think she's already left.
Okay. So that's probably a pretty big deal.
Who gets the directorship?
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think it'll speak to the direction he wants to take the department in, and I think that's something everyone is eager to see. So that's definitely one to be looking out for.
Right.
And he said he's Governor-elect DeWine has indicated he'll be making appointments as they are, you know, ready to roll out. And I think there's going to be maybe a couple more announcements this week.
At the beginning, what's it like covering someone like DeWine compared to a John Kasich, Kathy Kandisky?
DeWine's pretty approachable. I mean, he seems pretty low key to me. Maybe it's just because I've been around and know him. You know, you always see him out and about with his kids. I live in Worthington, and he's got some grandkids that live in our area. So it's not unusual to see him and Fran pop up at baseball games and things like that. They just seem pretty down to earth, pretty approachable.
Yeah,
I don't expect him to be running for president.
Right.
Yeah, I would say
I've never sensed that he dislikes the media either.
No,
No, his daughter is a journalist.
Right.
Yeah. I think Mike DeWine is, like Kathy said, he's everywhere, all over the state, and he pops up all over the place. He's also been really accessible over the last 8 years as the attorney general. I mean, you call up the AG's office and say, well, I was wondering about, you know, X, Y, or Z, and they get him on the horn for you pretty quick.
Right. Yeah, he comes on the show, too. Right. I'll be interested to see if he does, now that he's governor. It's been 8 years. I like getting a governor on the show. Let's take a quick break. My guests are Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, and Jesse Balmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. There's lots to talk about. We have a whole new slate of statewide elected executive office holders, including who we've just been talking about, Governor-elect Mike DeWine. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Columbus Dispatch reporter Kathy Kandisky, Dayton Daily News Columbus Bureau reporter Laura Bischoff, and Cincinnati Enquirer state government reporter Jesse Balmert. Question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What did I miss?
We're just making hand signals for the webcams. Oh. You know, for those listeners who are just on the radio, you can tune in also on the...
Yeah, you can actually watch us. Feast your eyes.
You can see us acting goofy.
Monday morning
antics.
Feast for the eyes. Yeah.
It's the first Monday a lot of us have worked for a couple weeks.
It is. Yeah. And you're gearing up. Is this... inauguration day used to be a big deal. There was a lot of stuff going on. We tried to get around and get to every event kind of a thing. Is that as much of a big deal these days, Laura Bischoff?
Not so much.
That's
because there's not a lot of news that happens in those events. And also this year, the DeWine folks are going to do a pool. They're going to have a pool reporter at most of these events.
I noticed that. And in fact, the private swearing in...
is going to be the Xenia Gazette is going to be the pool reporter. Yeah. Dayton Daily News. Oh, wait, who's going to be the AP? Is it Dispatch or AP is going to be the photographer?
AP.
I don't know.
For the one in
right. So
Yellow
there's
going to
be, yeah, and then you know the ceremonial swearing in and the rotunda of the State House the following day at noon. Again, they're going to have a pool photographer and pool reporter, but honestly, I'm not too upset about that because if something...
It's one less thing to have to worry about.
Well, also, I mean, we'll be watching it online from the press room a few feet away.
In
and
our
then,
jammies, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, but what I was going to say is if,
down
if
your
something...
Down in basement.
You know, but honestly, if something crazy happens, you can easily dash in and find out what's going on.
Yeah.
Your point well taken, Laura. There's usually not any news made. But the other thing I noted this year is in the past, we've had big galas, big balls, so to speak, dances and things like that, music. I don't think DeWine has anything like that scheduled. It's much more low-key.
The one thing they're pumping up a lot is this event at the U.S. Air Force Museum in over by Dayton.
Force.
No,
mm-hmm.
over by Dayton.
Oh.
The U.S. Air Force Museum.
Oh,
it's
right.
At Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It's a really spectacular museum, open year-round and free, which is my favorite price. They're having a family fun day on Sunday.
There is news. Jesse Balmert, you just wrote about it. Legislative aide has accused three Republican lawmakers and other staff linked to Larry Householder, who's seeking the speaker's slot, it's accused him of racist and sexist comments in a letter to a Democratic legislator. What's going on? This was y'all happened yesterday.
Yeah. So essentially, what happened is this legislative aide, Marissa Reyes, she sent a letter to Democrat Kristen Boggs, who is the representative for her area where she lives. And she was concerned that Democrats are supporting Larry Householder's bid for speaker and wanted to share some concerns she had with lawmakers who are supporters and affiliated with Larry Householder. She named three different lawmakers and reported comments they made about, relative to her race as a person of Latina descent, and then also spoke just kind of inappropriately about women. And I was able to contact at least one lawmaker, and I have calls out to the other ones. One rep, Scott Wiggum, who she reported to for several months, said that the allegations against him were not true and he wanted a full investigation into it. So it's a number of things that these lawmakers and then a number of staffers made relative to, like, being from Mexico or so forth.
She says during her time as staffer, she had to endure months of unacceptable treatment and was forced to listen to the representatives' opinions that painted myself, my family, and other Hispanics in a demeaning light. When I respectfully disagreed with the representative about an issue, I was told that women do not think logically. They think with their hearts, not with their brains.
Wow. We're working on it.
We're working on it. Yeah. I'm working on it. Let's see if I can manage to get through this letter.
Yeah. She sent the letter to Rep. Boggs, the Democrat, and then she also posted on Twitter yesterday afternoon, tagging a number of reporters, including myself, and that was when, I started to look into some of these things.
Max in Columbus, that's what you want to talk about. Welcome to the show, Max.
Hi, thanks. You guys pretty much answered all the questions I just had. I called in at the wrong time.
Okay.
That's
well,
it.
We glad we could be so thorough.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What was that? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I guess I didn't catch, is anyone's votes being swayed by this?
It's early yet, but Jesse Ballmer?
So I spoke with Kristen Boggs yesterday, and she said she, was very concerned about the comments. She found them, just really problematic. She is a little concerned about what to do, with just such a short timeline before the vote later today. On one hand, these are people affiliated with Larry Householder, but no allegations were made about Householder himself. On the other hand, these incidents would have happened while Brian Smith is in charge of the Ohio House. One thing that the legislative aide says in the letter is that she reported some of these concerns, and the House confirmed that there was a report of a complaint in late September. And so there is an investigation into at least some of these things that are detailed in the letter, and that is ongoing, and there hasn't been a conclusion drawn about that yet.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sorry, I wasn't listening. I was riveted to that letter. So, it's pretty spicy. Where can people get a copy of this? Is it available at...
So I linked to it in my story at cincinnati.com,
okay. But
also it is on Twitter.
Okay. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard Jesse Ballmer of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Also with us, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. What's the follow-up to this, though? Because the vote is today. I mean, it's kind of late in the game.
It's late in the game. I guess the lawmakers that will want to watch to see if it has any sway would be the Democrats, to see if it has any sway with their caucus. And that we just don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sure it'll be talked about when they caucus this morning.
Okay.
I think it'll be difficult because obviously they'll want to investigate each of these allegations and concerns, and we're just not going to have answers on that by this afternoon. And so you're going to be making a decision with imperfect information.
But it is a cloud. I mean—
Sure, and
do they need another cloud?
There's so many clouds over the State House.
Yeah,
it's interesting. The timing of it seems questionable. However, it just came out on Friday afternoon that the Democrats were looking to splinter.
Exactly. She was specifically said in the letter she was responding to that.
Correct.
She saw how close it was.
The question I have is, what's happened to her complaint? What's happened to her complaint that she made several months ago? Evidently. Has anything come of it? Why is it taking so long for that to get you know, resolved. It seems like we should have answers to that.
Already.
And so the question is, why don't we? And is there anything being done on her, on behalf of her complaint?
Well, the chief administrative officer for the Ohio House is leaving after a long time and is joining Robert Sprague's administration in the treasurer's office. So
and
I don't know.
That?
Kim Flasher.
Okay.
So I don't know if disruption in that service is part of the issue or
right.
if there's something else going on. There are plenty of clouds, though.
I there mean,
keep in mind that
all the time.
This is Central Ohio, after all. But all right. So what do we know about what, or if anything, what the lieutenant governor, John Husted, is going to do with job development in Ohio? What does anything more known about? We know he's going to make a lot more money.
Yeah. So he is going to be in charge of this Innovate Ohio program agency in Ohio. And they talked about it a little bit on the campaign trail relative to improving technology and business and also in schools and education. Recently, when lawmakers voted to approve the pay raise and the benefits for the survivors of officers who are killed in the line of duty, they included money for Innovate Ohio. But last week, when we all asked a little bit about, you know, what does this actually look like? How many people would be there? What would this agency actually do? Dewine said that, you know, information was forthcoming.
Hmm. Yeah. So
sounds like
stay
details
tuned.
Are still being worked out.
Get the money, answer questions later.
Right. John Husted does have experience in the business community. He was, before he became a state lawmaker, he was a vice president for the Dayton Area Chamber of Commerce. So maybe they're going to build off those connections in some way.
And I think there's some precedent for lieutenant governors to be involved in jobs development. I mean, I think Lee Fisher was famously involved in that. I'm trying to think who else. Taylor did insurance.
Right. And then Maureen O'Connor was public safety director. So it's pretty common for the LG to get like a department head position as well.
But I also think you'll see John Husted more involved than perhaps recent lieutenant governors. That's something that Mike DeWine said on the campaign trail. And even the day that he was elected on election night, he was saying that Husted is going to be, you know, really involved in this administration. And so I think that's something that might be a change from like Mary Taylor currently.
Well, right. She's a cabinet member.
Mary Taylor.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also keep in mind that Mary Taylor and John Husted or John Kasich really splintered in the last couple of years of the administration.
Bragging about the fact that they never talked to each other.
Right. That they said even though she's lieutenant governor, they hadn't talked in at least a couple of years.
Which is
strange.
Very strange, right. I think. Is that could it be even true?
You know, what's interesting is I did a story during the campaign last year, I was interviewing Dave Yost and I asked him a question about independence from other office holders. And he said, well, I've already exhibited my independence. I haven't talked to John Kasich in at least a year. And I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, don't so you guys then, like ever like?
So then just... I called Josh Mandel, the treasurer's office, to find out.
These are all the same party, by the way, listeners.
Right, they're all the same party, and across the board, they had not talked to John Kasich in at least a year. And I think that you know, some of the animosity with the legislators also came because they felt like he was an absentee governor, and that they went and supported him on his presidential run. They, you know, a bunch of them went out to New Hampshire and knocked on doors in a snowstorm, and. Then they got radio silence after that.
I know the feeling. Yeah, Kathy.
Well, I think I agree with everything Laura said. I just think it also speaks to the fact that every office is held by a Republican and they're all trying to distinguish themselves in some way. And so there's maybe not the kind of working together that we would have seen had, say, there been two or three Republicans in statewide executive offices.
Yeah, the cannibalization of the party, that's not... Not the first time. Probably won't be the last. I mean, busy guys. All right. So back to John Kasich. Always a fun conversation. He recently appointed four people to the State Board of Education. How was this taken?
Well, what was interesting about the appointments, of course, the governor has 8 seats that he can appoint to on the State Board of Education. Half of them come up every 2 years. So he had 4 seats to fill before he left office. He appointed 4 business folks. Three of the folks he appointed had their own companies or head of companies, manufacturing companies and such. And one was a realtor from, I believe, Fairfield or Licking County, close to Ohio. The thing that was noteworthy about them is, other than one that had served on his local state or local school board, none of them seem to have education experience, which is kind of different.
But he has said that we need to get education out of the classroom and into the workplace.
Right. He's real big on what does the business community need from our education system. That's kind of his approach to education, is what do we need to do to make kids, when they graduate, employable, and what does business need out of our schools. So it's not surprising in that point. But if you look at the makeup of all the elected members on the State Board of Education, most of them are retired teachers, former school board members, educators of some sort.
Yeah, I would say this is very in line with what John Kasich has been saying and doing for a while. If you recall the last budget, he tried to add externships for teachers to spend time with businesses. He's tried to get business members on local school boards. So this is kind of the route he's been taking. It hasn't been very successful with the state lawmakers, but these appointments are something he can do without their approval.
An email from Evan. He says, since Ohio elected Republicans to all statewide offices, how will this affect the redistricting process, since we need to reapportion districts? Of course, that's in 2020 after the census. We're going to lose a congressional seat, I guess. There's new rules in place that are supposed to create a little bit more balance. Kathy Kandisky?
You're right. There's new rules in place that are supposed to be able to create some more balance. But ultimately, the Republicans still control the process. We'll see how it plays out. I mean, a lot of people have hope that it will mitigate things somewhat, but I really don't know how to read it. We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, it's really, it is such a highly political process, and to try to remove all politics from it is,
not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
Without drastically changing how it
Right. And
it
even
works.
There was a lot of agreement from the outside groups, like the League of Women Voters and others, that were trying to put a redistricting issue on the ballot. And then they struck a deal with the legislators. And, we got the compromise one on the ballot, mm-hmm. and it passed. But like the ACLU of Ohio, they I think they were neutral or maybe opposed to it. I can't remember. And they just said, we're not convinced that it's going to remove the politics and that it's going to result in the balanced districts that a lot of people think are
needed. I think the
hope
is that it's a step in the right direction. Nobody thinks it's a fix.
Under the best circumstances, anyway, it'll take years to of shifting sands, because people are holding office now and the incumbents always have an advantage. And
right. And they have the Republicans have a strong bench. They have lots of people who are in position, lower level positions, ready to move up.
Right.
And the Democrats have always had a hard time with their bench. They draw a lot from the cities, but then,
right.
A mayor from a mid-sized Ohio city isn't known statewide.
Right. We're going to continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment for our weekly reporter roundtable, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Columbus Dispatch reporter Kathy Kandisky, from the Dayton Daily News, Laura Bischoff, and from the Cincinnati Enquirer, Jesse Ballmer. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. As Jesse Ballmer said during the break, it was sort of like write your Sherrod Brown profile over the Christmas and other holidays. And I thought it was more like write your Connie Schultz profile, the spouse of Sherrod Brown season. She got a lot of ink this over the holidays. Kathy Kandiski?
She's an interesting person in her own right, and they are very much a team, it seems, in this effort to see whether he's going to run for president or not. And as she's made very clear that nothing's going to happen without her approval. I think that's the case with most spouses of presidential candidates, but she to hear someone come out and say it like she did is new for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's different.
Right. So for those who don't know who Connie Schultz is, she's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist mm-hmm. and who worked for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, author. She also teaches at, I believe at Kent State University. Mm-hmm. She's got a lot of blue collar, cred. And she is a freelance journalist.
A columnist.
Right.
And at work on her first novel.
Right.
And as then, well.
She's had a couple novels, but yeah.
Oh, she has? Oh, okay. I thought she wrote a memoir.
She wrote a memoir,
and I think it's her first novel.
And his lovely wife is her memoir
about being a wife of a U.S. senator and how that kind of went down, how she was treated.
Yeah. So she's very outspoken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, the write up in Politico was interesting. It was pretty lengthy, and I think the headline was, here's a woman. I think she was quoted saying something like, I'm the woman that Donald Trump hates, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. So there we go.
Kind of sums it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. There's a lot of interest in Sherrod Brown right now, obviously, as he considers a presidential bid. And I don't think the larger national audience knows who Sherrod Brown is that much. They might know him as, a progressive or that gravelly voiced, rumpled guy.
I was going to say, they recognize his voice, yeah.
But I don't think he's very well known nationally. And so I think it's probably an attempt from him and his team and writers to find out a little bit more about him.
She can really help him. I mean, she can really help him. Women did really well this last election. And having her out front with him, I think, can be a real help. I think it'll appeal to a lot of women.
And also, that blue collar cred. Is solid and a proud, she's proud and likes to talk about and has pretty much her whole career.
Right. And not to overshadow him, I mean, he's pretty strong in the industrial Midwestern states, too. He should do very well amongst that crowd.
And I guess the question is, will they do well among the people who voted for Donald Trump? That's the question.
Right.
What's interesting is he ran for re-election and beat Jim Renacci, but not by the biggest margin expected, particularly given how much more money his side had.
A lot of people thought it would be double digits, maybe low double digits, but double digits, and it was like 7-8%.
Right. And, but at the same time, the Cordray-DeWine race was supposed to be close, and the down ticket races were supposed to be close, and
nothing.
Republicans walked away with it. Right. So, anyway, I do think that Sherrod Brown not being very well known works both for and against him. It's an opportunity for him to kind of craft his own narrative about his candidacy if he were to choose to run for president. But it just takes a ton of money to get that out there.
All right, Kathy. Over the holidays, you wrote about how the Ohio Department of Medicaid announced that its planned prescription drug program. That would have saved taxpayers about $42 million over the next 2 years would be delayed indefinitely. What's going on?
It's been delayed indefinitely. What they were going to do, what the state was going to do and had long planned to do, this was in the last Kasich budget, was to create its own formulary or its own list of medications that would be covered by the Medicaid program. Right now, that's deferred to the managed care companies and the pharmacy benefit managers that they hire, decide which drugs are covered, and a lot of times it's based on rebates and things like that. The state thought it could save some money by doing that itself. They've ultimately decided to hold off on that because they're doing some other changes to the drug benefit program. Some people questioned why. The state said they just want to stay focused on what's in front of them at this point. I thought it was kind of suspicious. Why wouldn't you want to save the money? but we'll see what happens.
You know, Laura, you wrote about the year in Ohio politics over the holidays, and one of the issues that you wrote about in that was that the blue wave didn't hit Ohio, and we just kind of, you know, went over that, that unlike other states, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, there was no turnover at all.
Right, and that has a lot of analysts kind of thinking, is Ohio still a swing state? Is it still a bellwether, or is it more of a red state now? I think that in non-presidential years, it's definitely a red state. In presidential years, it might still be a swing state, you know, because it went for Clinton and then Bush and then Obama and now Trump. So it does kind of flip back and forth. But the blue wave didn't. I mean, the Democrats picked up 2 seats on the Ohio Supreme Court.
Yep. 4 or 5 in the House.
4 or 5 in the House. Would they pick up 1 in the Senate? Or did, was it a wash? It was a wash.
It was a wash in the Senate.
But the, a lot of people say look deeper than just who won and who lost. And the in, like, you could take the 12th Congressional District is, the I guess, the classic example. It was a lot closer than it's ever been in a really strongly drawn Republican district.
I think all that speaks to Franklin County in particular as being a lot more Democratic than it's been. I mean, it's always been, but a lot more Democratic. I think that a lot voter turnout in Franklin County, which is Columbus, obviously, was really, really high compared to some of the other areas, the more rural areas of that district. And I think that is what helped keep that race as tight as it was.
You know, and that high voter turnout has you know, it's good to see lots of people getting excited and voting. The downside, though, is for folks who want to try and put issues on the ballot, the threshold for the number of signatures required to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, it'll go from like 306 to 400, from like 306,000 to, I think, 440,000.
Right. Significant.
So it's, yeah, it's based on the percentage of people who cast a ballot in the last election. In the last gubernatorial election. And, I, you know, the turnout was so low during the Kasich-Ed Fitzgerald race in 2014.
That it made it that much easier.
That it made it easier. And then now it's the flip side is that it's going to be a lot harder. And I do think that the lawmakers are still interested in changing the process for citizen-initiated constitutional amendments. They feel like there's special interests that are kind of buying their way into the Ohio Constitution and that that's corrupting it. You talk to interest groups, though, and they say it's already hard enough, and what you should be doing is making the citizen-initiated statute process, which to get a law on,
which means
easier,
yes, versus amending the Constitution,
right? To make it easier, and you know,
and making it harder for the legislature to come behind any kind of voter,
right? Because you could spend millions of dollars and all this energy to get all these signatures, get it on the ballot, get it passed, and then the next day the lawmakers could change it. So
why do
so
that?
So they would, you know, there's talk about maybe there should be a safe harbor in which there's no monkeying around with a voter approved change for a certain amount of time.
Tricky,
but there, you know, like a lot of the big policy changes that have come to Ohio have come through the ballot,
either through the ballot or
through the threat of the ballot.
Threat of the ballot, right?
Right. Redistricting, right.
Medical marijuana,
right. Casino gambling, gay marriage ban, the indoor smoking ban.
Right.
And right now, for all the reasons that Laura listed, it's just, it makes so much more sense to go through the Constitution because it is a permanent document as opposed to going through this initiated statute process, and that's why very few people use that other method.
But a lot of people, you know, a lot of people, and I guess I should say academic scholars, have a real issue with kind of junking up the Constitution with a lot of these policy type issues, that those are better handled through the law rather than through the Constitution.
So one of the things they've offered
is to
pull back, like limit how soon the Ohio General Assembly can amend an initiated statute.
Right. Some of the citizen groups have talked about maybe doing a safe harbor of no changes to voter-approved statutes for like 5 years. And I think that the lawmakers would prefer that it be like 5 minutes.
Yeah, right. You know? I think they proposed, or at least one proposal I saw, was a year.
Right.
Or maybe 2. But even still, a year. I mean, after it goes into effect, a year, that means you're changing policy that's in effect. And that's always harder to do.
Right. And after the indoor smoking ban passed, there was an effort to water down those
in private
restrictions
clubs and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And, you know, likewise, you know, the voters in 2008 said that they wanted to put limits on payday lending. And they it wasn't a citizen initiated statute. It was a matter of the lawmakers passed these restrictions and then the payday lending industry put it up for a referendum. And the voters wholeheartedly said, no, we like the restrictions. Mm-hmm. And then they for 10 years, the lawmakers turned a blind eye while the payday lenders found other loopholes in which to.
And it, I think it's interesting because they had House Bill 123 sitting there for months. And we're not going to take action, or didn't appear to be taking action on it. It wasn't until
we found out that the FBI was after Cliff Rosenberger,
right,
and that he admitted to the Dayton Daily News that he had hired a criminal defense attorney, and then 5 days later he resigned.
And revolving around payday lending lobbyists,
right? Well, he went traveling worldwide to China, Normandy, France, London, Iceland, with payday lenders footing part of the bill at least. And that the subpoena and the search warrant that the Ohio House received, it lays out a whole roadmap, and that's where it goes, is to the payday lending.
And to extinguish any doubt about that, or at least try to, they had to pass the bill.
That was the first act that Ryan Smith did as the new speaker, when he grabbed the speakership, and then next thing you know, that bill was on the floor.
Tame the payday lenders. Tame them. So what's coming up this week? You're expecting more appointments? I mean, what are you going to be covering? Because until it's all lame-ish right now.
Everyone's going to be sworn in this week, so we'll be covering that. We'll be covering probably
next
doing
week.
Next week's.
Yeah.
I think some of the down ticket office holders are actually being sworn in this week, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
DeWine on Sunday.
Okay.
So there's not any legislative action yet, but I think Laura actually already had a story. We'll all be writing about what's coming up once they get back into session in the coming weeks. And there's a lot of bills that probably coming back from last year that they'll probably work on first. That heartbeat bill is probably the first one.
It's a whole bunch of rinse and repeat, you know? I mean, they're going to do stand your ground gun legislation, probably the heartbeat ban, abortion mm-hmm. ban bill.
Right.
You know, they still haven't fixed the unemployment compensation fund,
now,
which is
I don't have
underfunded.
A lot of faith that that's going to happen.
If they haven't
honestly.
Done that by now.
They're going to just wait till it goes broke again, and then
yeah,
they have to
I mean,
borrow a bunch of money
again
from the
feds. If they don't do anything. And even the compromises that they were talking about, we're not really going to sustain it properly.
If we get a recession, it goes broke within a year.
Yeah, versus the last recession, which I think it took about 2 years.
Right.
It'll go faster this time.
It'll go quick. It's it's well below the minimum safe level that the state imposes.
The opiate crisis is still a big dumpster fire across Ohio. Yeah. They got to keep working on that. And then, you know, the budget bill, that'll be...
But it looks to be different, though, because... I think, or people predict, I mean, different in that it's been a big policy vehicle for the Kasich administration for the last.
I think it's always a policy vehicle.
Well,
they put in things like tuition freezes and tax rates. And
he just made such a big stink about it, I guess. You're right. It's always been a policy
vehicle.
Well,
one thing DeWine has talked a lot about is children's issues, and he's created an office. I think I forget the formal name of it, but like Children Initiatives or something. I expect the budget to speak directly to that effort for sure.
Right, and you know, separately also is the transportation budget bill that'll come out first, and you know, the state's going to run out of that money that the Kasich administration like issued bonds against future tolls of the turnpike,
right?
So then, you know, the question is, how does Ohio pay for its road and bridge
programs? All
these
new roads and bridges that it's built now they have to maintain them,
and the gas tax is at 28 cents a gallon, the state gas tax, and I think the last increase was during the Taft administration in 2005.
Huh.
So, and gas prices are super low right now, but nobody likes a tax increase at the pump.
Yeah, but if you all right, nobody likes a tax increase, so just remember that next time you drive over
a giant pothole that wrecks your front end.
On a state road. Otherwise, you can just blame Columbus.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the state budget, how Ohio spends its money, is always going to be linked to policy and priorities. And it'll be really interesting to see how DeWine leads this and how Ohio lawmakers are able to work it through, especially with these divisions in the Ohio House.
That is it. Jesse Ballmer, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Jesse Ballmer of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Also, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Thanks, Laura, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.